Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Hello and welcome to Cutting the Curd. I'm Greg Blaze and I'm recording today live from Lucy's Way in the Upper East Side with my good friend Jason Hines, who's here on Cheesemonger Invitational Day. I'm here with Jason for our annual episode. It's become a Cutting the Curd tradition to have you on the show. Thank you for taking the time out to chat with us.
It's a pleasure, as always, to be here to chat with you, Greg.
Thank you. To this day, episode 269, Effective Cheesemonger, is one I continually go back to, and actually Emily and I have created a session at Culture Magazine's Counterculture events that uses your tasks versus work framework. And we really find that it's helpful. It gets in there.
Yeah.
Because people don't know. They don't know the difference. And as that episode gains maturity, like a cheddar, gets better with age. So I really appreciated your input there.
Any little bits of, any little nuggets of clarity that we can bring to the table, we're grateful.
Most definitely we are. I wanted to talk to you in the beginning part of our little session here about some topics that are a little bit difficult, but definitely poignant in our world. What I wanted to mention to you or ask you about was your opinion on things like terrorism in tourist markets and cheesemongering in large areas. And that's recently come to affect you most directly, has it not?
Well, the most recent events in London were on our doorstep. And when I say they were on our doorstep, the assassination of those assailants was maybe 40 meters away from the entrance to our cheese shop.
That's insane.
Mercifully, the store was closed because the attack was at night.
Okay.
But it was a completely random attack. It could have happened during the day. Had they attacked earlier on in the day, and it was a Saturday, the market would have been at its busiest.
Sure.
Had they managed to rent the truck, the larger truck they were trying to rent, but were turned down because the credit company wouldn't accept the large payment that was required to rent this much larger truck, they would have attacked earlier and in a much larger truck. And there would have been many more people present at the market. So it's the random nature of it that is so frightening. And that's what I think, you know, everyone in London, including, the, you know, many of the folks in our team find so troubling, is that, you know, it could be anyone. It could be anyone. And that's the most troubling thing. And I think that's the it's that factor of fear of the unknown and the randomness of it, which makes everyone feel so uncomfortable.
That's what terrorism is. Mm. It's fear-mongering at its worst, and cowardice at its worst. I also work in one of the busiest cities in the world. Italy, we are, you know, we're extremely busy. And, you know, there's just all types of people afoot. Mm. It makes me, as a New Yorker, and when I see things like that happen, I can understand when I was here following 9/11, there were people that I came to work with every day that said, "I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. I can't deal with this." And they pieced right out. I'm on the other end. I'm like, "No, fuck you. I'm staying. This is absolutely where I live. Yeah. No one's getting me out of where I live." Is that, were your people that same way?
I think everyone feels that way. And I think there's a sort of, you know, it is true to say that through the worst examples of human behavior, you can often then solicit the best examples of human behavior. And I think the way, I don't know, I know it's a little bit of a cliche, but, you know, the community of people in London of all races, creeds, colors, and religions have come together in a way that perhaps they weren't before the attack. And it's all you have to remember also, London is not new.
Not at all.
To terror. You know, we've had various iterations, different phases of attacks from different groups over the course of the last 40 years or so. So this is just a different group, but it's no less alarming. I think that for our staff particularly, you know, there were anxious moments, more because the store was closed for 8 days after the attack, because it was such a serious attack. The whole area was cordoned off by the police. And the forensic folks were in there for an awful long time, you know, piecing everything together. And the area was on armed lockdown, and one was not able to get in to the area.
That's right.
Apart from the few people who lived in the zone who were allowed in. But it felt like it was very serious for a number of days after the attack, when of course things were serious. And it was only, I think, a week past Wednesday that the shop reopened. So, you know, that's quite some time. And in all of that time, I think people think about what's happened, and actually thinking about it is worse. If you can just get back on the horse,
sure,
that's often the best thing to be doing.
That's what I really wanted to ask you. What happened for me post 9/11 when I was here, and I was quite close. I was below the lower checkpoints. My perspective was a little bit different.
Yeah.
I came to appreciate a lot more what I did for a living and just how peaceable and wonderful that it was. And I wondered if you saw that in your customers and your employees when they were able to get back into their routine. And did that, you know, did that register with them? Just how lucky we are to live and be able to do the things that we do do.
That didn't happen immediately. I think there was a day of adjustment, and then I think the waves of relief washed upon everyone. And then I think you get your hands back on a piece of cheese. You're in front of a customer who really appreciates it. And you relearn why it is you do what you do and why you enjoy it so much.
Yeah.
But there was a very nasty interlude there for a lot of them. But I think, you know, now we are back to normal and very grateful to be so.
Well, that's great, and I'm glad that you're okay.
We're all good.
That's a scary time. Mm. There's the politics of the world and the way that the world is set up are changing drastically. Yeah. I don't know, for better or worse, I just do know that things are becoming a little bit different.
Well, and I think what you have to recognize is that there is something has changed, and you can't just carry on as you did before. So if you go to the market now, and I went back the day after it had reopened, and it looked and felt different. Why? Because all of a sudden there was bollards that prevented people going down the street that a week before you were able to drive down. Why? Because there was a lot more police there than before. one or two of them armed. An unusual sight in London, because the police are not really armed in London. And so I think, you know, I suppose just as I, you know, the store that you work in is one of the most populated spots of any place that's visited in the city.
Absolutely.
Borough Market, I believe, now is the most visited spot of any place in London. There are millions of people going there every year, and we can't be blasé enough to think that it's not a genuine target. It is. And so we have to at least put some steps in to make people safer.
Yeah. It's telling, and it really, really hits me. I've worked with you in the Borough Market very briefly back in the days, and I really love the energy there. I love outdoor markets, and I love outdoor markets for selling cheese. I think it's the best.
Particularly in a cool climate like
that. Oh, yeah, it's great. The cheese doesn't sweat, you know? but it's something that I think about, that I've always thought about here, just working here in a climate where, you know, things are so intense.
Yeah.
And it bleeds over into less deadly things than terrorism. When we take a look at the politics around what we do, that sort of fear, I feel, has crept into the politics of food, and specifically cheese, as insofar as what I see from my own government on a federal level, in the way that they become extremely, you know, this is a very litigious and regulatory environment. Are you feeling that where you're from as well?
I don't think we feel quite the same, you know, the same pressures that you've been under in the last couple of years here. But there's no question that it seems like things are becoming more regulatory, and you know there is testing techniques are more sophisticated. It's easier to find the things you want to find,
sure,
and it's easier to turn the spotlight on something you want to choose to that you choose to turn the spotlight on, and you know the onus is just as the onus is on the people. To keep the market safe by making sure that the right checks and balances and there's the right level of security around the market. So I think it's also appropriate that that there should be the right levels of safety around cheese manufacture and food manufacture. It shouldn't be onerous, shouldn't be too heavy and overprescribed, but it shouldn't be absent too.
Sure.
And I think it's finding that level, which is the difficult thing. And it's a very, you know, it's a fine balance to find.
Why here more than there?
I don't think it is. I think it's not that it's more. I don't know that it's more here than there. It just feels like that. I'm not in this market, but I do know that in recent years there's been a lot of activity and and the spotlight that we just referred to has really been pointed on raw milk cheese. And, you know, as a company, most of the cheeses that we work with are made with raw milk.
Yeah.
As a company, I think we probably are the company that exports more raw milk cheese to the US than any other. So when the spotlight was turned on the imports of raw milk cheese, we had many more cheeses that were stopped, tested, than any other company.
Sure.
Ours is the greatest percentage of raw milk cheeses that were tested of the quota that they were required to test. So we did feel a little bit picked upon. And
are you pushing through that?
Well, that's been, you know, the testing was done, and you know, we came out with we came out with no positive results, which is a good thing. So I think that we redeemed the cheeses that the cheeses that we export and the people that make those cheeses came out with flying colours. But the process took a long time. It cost us as a company a lot of money, we did feel slightly victimised. But in the end, I think that the spotlight is now shining on someone else or something else. And we're glad not to have the spotlight shining on us.
Money is an important factor when it comes to dealing with all of this. What I'm finding in my travels lately, I was up in Vermont and I've been visiting producers that money that you were spending, that Neil's Yard Dairy was spending, that was to protect your producers,
yeah.
correct?
Yeah.
So you were in effect paying for their for their testing.
Yeah.
Here,
well,
in the,
we were. Well, I think that in the end, the testing, they, you know, the testing that was being done, they were paying for. But we also contributed to, we lost the cheese. We didn't get repaid for all the cheese
right.
that was...
You absorbed those losses.
Yeah, we're talking about losses that amount to thousands and thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you're right to say that you know, the money that we've spent there is securing the future market for the cheesemakers that have come to depend on that market over the last 25 years or so.
This is my largest fear about... or one of my largest fears about the U.S. artisan cheese market of a raw milk, cheeses that are made of a raw milk nature, that there's the advocacy for them and the ability to get that done through distributors, which you are, is just not there. I don't think, maybe it is, but I'm not seeing it there in America.
No.
When I visited some cheesemakers, they were telling me, and I'm not going to name names, but they were telling me that the, you know, people were coming in to test them.
Mm-mm.
And one of the people I was touring with said, well, what are they testing you for? And the guy was like, I don't know.
Mm-mm.
And I'm like, well, how the fuck does that make sense?
Mm-mm.
So I've found, and especially in light of a lot of stuff that's gone on here, recalls, issues with raw milk, particular problems that we've had, I just really, and I know we've talked about this ad nauseum, but it's still affecting me. It's like, yeah, we know this. We know that no one's out there, that the state governments aren't really supporting them, the federal governments aren't really supporting them. But let's move on to something else. But I find it hard because those chickens are, you know, are going to come home to roost quickly, and I fear for my industry, for people who are new to the industry, if that makes sense.
And I
also find that somewhere along the line that's going to affect quality, because cheese needs to mature, certain cheese. And I was given cheese that wasn't ready for sale, but I knew that it had to be pushed out of where I was. And so I had for the first time in my entire career, I had a real ethical dilemma with that. I love to support cheesemakers, and if you have extra cheese, I'll buy it. You know, if I can support you in any way, I try to. Italy is great about that. We're fantastic. But buying cheese that isn't ready to offset other costs, man, that's a tough spot for me to be in. You know?
But there's another point too, which is that you know, in terms of safeguarding the future, because we're in a market, we're working in a market with a product that's increasingly in demand. People are looking for food with flavor. They're looking for cheese with flavor, and so there's a lot of cheese makers have come into the market recently in the last 1 to 15 years.
Many,
and they need to be encouraged to do so. One, because there's a market. And they know there's going to be a demand for the cheese that they might make, because there's an increasing demanding public. But also they want to know that actually it's not going to be too difficult for them to make this stuff.
Certainly.
Because there's not too many regulations around it, and that they're going to be able to make something that they're passionate about making. So, you know, it's important that yes, there must be regulations around all of this. But if it's too onerous, then they'll be encouraged to go and do something else. And then we all, as cheese businesses that sell cheese, are in a difficult spot, because we all know that we depend entirely for our livelihoods on people who are making great cheese.
Yes, we do. That's tough. Tough, but an interesting thing to speak about. Well, thank you for that interlude. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and talk about something that you briefly mentioned to me while we were having lunch here, which was...
Direction of travel.
Mm. So stick with us, and we'll talk about that straight away.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth-generation cheesemakers, combining old-world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh cheese curds. Or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirsois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com, and as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. I'm still here at Lucy's Way with Jason Hines. I've managed to secure him for at least another 10 minutes in his travels, so I'm happy to have him here. And there was a thing that you mentioned right before the break, direction of travel. I'm always interested to hear what you have to say, your philosophies, your historian nature, as I believe you to be a very, very good historian. And I really, really appreciate your view of the past and how things came to be. Your legend is my reality, and I'm completely comfortable with that. So thank you.
You're welcome.
For all of that knowledge that you bestowed upon me. So let's talk a little bit about direction of travel. What does that mean?
So I've just been thinking in the last few months as I've been coming to the States, so impressed by how fast things are moving, quality of the cheese that's being produced, the youth of the people making the cheese, the quality and youth of the people selling the cheese. And I'm watching that direction of travel. I'm looking at how things are evolving, because I've been coming and watching these things in the US market, cheese marketplace, since 1992. Mm-hmm. And if I cast my mind back 25 years, where we are now from where we were then, it's
unrecognizable.
Utterly unrecognizable.
Yeah, in a good way, I hope.
Indeed. And but the thing is that there are many similarities between the UK cheese market and how it's evolved, the UK specialist cheese market and how it's evolved, and the US specialty, I think you call it here.
Specialty,
we have an extra I in the word speciality. And so what's interesting to me is that our direction of travel is slightly further forward in time than yours. But I look back at what the events are, the events that
so
have
like
been...
Touchstone
events in our journey... I'm watching some of them happening in the US direction of travel. And so it's interesting now to zoom in a little bit as to what's happening in the UK, because maybe there could be some indications about, you know, what things you might come up against in the US if you're to look at our, you know, our direction of travel. Because let's take a couple of examples.
I'd like
We started in the 90s in the UK to see more and more new cheeses inspired by continental recipes beginning to appear. In the earlier, you know, in the decade before, there weren't really any soft mold ripened goat's milk cheeses or many soft cheeses at all.
Very few.
Made by hand. There was a few made in factories, but there weren't really any.
Mean in the United States?
In the UK.
Okay.
So we're going back to the 90s. We're in the United Kingdom, and people began making some of these continental soft. Often mould ripened, sometimes wash dried.
Like the Wigmore.
Wigmore would be an example. Our own cream, we made a cheese called Ragstone. There was Golden Cross. There were very few of these.
Scattered a little bit.
There were just very few of these types. And so what happened was that, you know, some of them were good, some of them were great, some of them were not so good.
Certainly.
But they all sold. And there was a much greater demand for these cheeses than any of these cheesemakers had the capacity to supply. So the problem became that the cheesemakers were not really motivated to continue to improve the trajectory of their quality, because the message they were getting from the marketplace is that it was fine because they couldn't make as much cheese as the market wanted.
Right.
And so, good for them, good for their business, but not necessarily good for their future.
Yeah.
So we got to a point. Let's just zoom in on the category of mulled ripe and goat's milk cheeses, inspired by the success of one or two, and with a great demand. More people began to make mould-ripened goat's milk cheese. And so during the course of the 2000s, the landscape changed. All of a sudden, there was more variety. And with that variety, competition meant that those who historically, it was their God-given rights to just have a never-ending demand for their cheese.
Yeah, for their mediocre product,
Correct.
They had to up their game.
That's exactly right. And so, that phase took about 15 years.
Sure.
From the point when there was very few, and they were sort of benchmarked the best in class. 10 to 15 years later, we started to have a much more competitive marketplace, which is much better for the consumer.
Certainly.
And actually, some of those earlier pretenders had to take a step back
and retool
to actually start to compete. And so that was a good phase. And I think, if I look around at what I'm seeing in the States, there's a lot of new people, a lot of new cheesemakers coming into the industry.
Many. I was talking with Andy Hatch about this yesterday. And an episode that will come out. There's a lot of cheese out there in the market, and there's a lot of cheese makers. But please go on.
But there's such a... Yeah, so there's a lot of cheese makers out there, but the range of quality is dramatic. But it will continue to remain dramatic, that range, as long as everybody is selling everything.
Right.
Okay, so what needs to happen is, as we are also adding the rank... we're adding to the ranks of the number of cheese shops out there.
Yes.
That demand is going to increase, and as that demand increases, the number of people encouraged to make cheese in the same categories increases too.
Sure.
And so you get to a point where competition begins to actually play a really positive, has a very positive effect on the trajectory of quality.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking that you're beginning to see some of that in the States, and in certain categories we're a little further ahead because. I think our country started to, develop an interest in these new fangled invented cheeses only 10 or 15 years before you did.
Right.
So,
or invented in your country.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. It interpretations.
Yeah.
Looking at that has led me to think a lot more about what does the next phase look like?
What's it looking like for you?
And I think that for us, we're starting to see something that's happening more and more. In the last 5 years or so, we've had more and more inquiries from dairy farmers, people who they have milk, and they may have been milking cows for a short while or for generations, but they're not helped by the vagaries of the commodity milk price.
Here's the key.
As cheese mongers, we're totally dependent on the people that supply us with cheese and the quality of cheese they supply us. Without those people, without that quality, we have no business. So as there are more cheesemongers appearing in the UK as well, where are they going to get that cheese from? Because I think we're on a collision course if we don't have the quality of milk to be transformed into cheese in the future. And the problem that I see is that with the commodity milk price as low as it has been, very often in the last 3 years, it's been less than the cost of the price of the milk has been less than the cost of the milk, the production of the milk. That clearly is not a sustainable position.
Not at all.
And the dairy farmers for whom it's the least sustainable are the small dairy farmers.
So
they're getting eaten up, or they're either disappearing altogether, or they're being bought. But typically, they're going out of business.
Either way, they're not existing in what the original iteration what they were.
Correct. And they either have to compromise the milk that they're producing and compromise that the quality of the milk they're producing, make more of it, and all they're
Which
doing
happens.
And all but all the thing is all they're doing by making more is creating is perpetuating the reason why the milk price is low.
Yeah, it's
because the milk price is low when you have a surplus of milk.
I know.
And so that's not a way to respond.
No, it
to
isn't.
Produce more.
We do that in the United States here when we do something called a currency ease.
Yeah.
Where we decide that we need more money, so we just print more money.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And we put more in
exactly,
the market.
Exactly.
And it's like that's why the dollar is worth 20% of what it was 10 years ago.
Quantitative easing. Yeah,
and that's what you're talking about, I think.
Well, so exactly, and so the problem is that in the meantime, either you make more milk and you keep you perpetuate a situation where there is a greater amount of milk than there is
a need,
and then the milk price will remain as low as it is. The only way the milk price can go up is if people stop producing it
and
there's no longer a surplus, there's a scarcity. But the people who are most likely to go to the wall are the small people who produce the best milk, which has the greatest potential for producing the best cheese.
It perpetuates our industry.
So what we've seen more of in recent years in the UK, we've had a number of approaches from these dairy farmers as a business, people knocking on the door saying, we have good milk, we think. We want to add value to that milk, because if we fail to do that, we will no longer be able to keep cows and produce milk. So therefore, to add the premium to that milk, we'd like to make cheese, because it seems that there's a way of adding value to the milk.
That's what it's
and we don't know what we don't know how to do it, we don't know what to do, we don't know where to get the information. Help. That's basically been, and we've had, you know, a goodly number of those inquiries.
Yeah.
And there are several cheeses that,
you're saving the milk.
So there's a few examples out there now of cheeses where that story has happened.
Which?
Tunworth is an example.
Certainly.
Was one of the first where they had at the time they had a small herd of Ayrshire cows. They needed to add value. They decided cheesemaking was what they wanted to do. And they came to us and spent some time understanding what type of cheese it was that they should make. There was no good handmade Camembert-style cheese being produced in the UK. And so we went down that track and worked very closely with them to help develop that cheese. And now it's a successful business.
You fill two needs.
Yeah.
You saved the milk and you made a cheese that wasn't in your market.
Exactly.
And you set the market for that cheese. And you gave other people an idea to do the same thing down the road.
Yeah.
That's all well.
So that's one example. There's another example that I know is a cheese that's close to your heart, which is Gorworth Caerphilly.
So
this is a good story because I think it's another iteration of, but it's finding solutions for transforming good milk into great cheese.
Sure.
And there are many people out there who are interested in making cheese, but don't have necessarily the wherewithal or the funds, particularly if they're young, to be able to go into buy a farm. Farms are expensive.
Goddamn right.
Land is expensive.
Yeah. Cheese-making equipment is expensive.
Farming is expensive.
Animals are expensive, too.
Yeah.
The upkeep of everything there, if you want to do it on a farmstead level, that's like buying a car one piece at a time. Like,
exactly.
I'll buy the tires from you, the engine from you, right?
Exactly.
And then you end up with this massive mountain of debt, and you lose sight of what your point was in the first place, I think.
That's exactly right. So in the Gorworth example, they were interested to move from West Wales to Somerset. They were interested in taking on a farm, but the cost of it was far too high.
Yeah.
It was unaffordable
for
them. So I remember very well having a chat with Martin about what they were going to do, and the reason for moving was he wanted better quality milk. The milk that he was buying in at the time in Wales wasn't producing great cheese, and so led by one single thing, which was find the best milk, he went to Somerset and started knocking on farm doors, dairy farm doors. And he was in the fortunate position that he already had a business transforming 500,000 litres of milk He had us as a customer, another big supermarket customer that's a very reputable customer in England. But what was interesting about this story is that he was looking for the best milk, and he knew there was dairy farmers out there that were looking to add value to their milk.
Sure.
Okay. So what's been nice about the story of the Trethowns for the last 3 or 4 years and the story of Gorworth Caerphilly is the marriage of two groups with different requirements that sync very well together.
Sure.
The farmer is looking at some way that he or she can add value to their milk. So they basically have an agreement where they pay a premium of a certain number of pence per litre over the market price of the milk, the market price that day of the milk.
That happens here too on a little scale. Mm. But I'm sorry, please go on.
So that's a real benefit to the farmer. And in some cases, you can also, I think they've also got written to the contract certain stipulations about what the quality of milk needs to be in order for them to pay
to get that price. Sure.
Yeah.
And then that shows itself in the end product of the cheese.
The better the quality, the better the milk is for the better the milk type is for the type of cheese they want to make, the more cheese they're going to sell.
That's interesting.
And so what they didn't need to do, because they're on farm, I mean, the milk is coming from the parlor straight into the vat.
Great.
It's a gravity-fed pump, and all of that was they were allowed to build all that into their system. The farm had space, it had land, it had cows. It just didn't have a premium,
sure.
And that's what they're looking for.
They added value.
The cheesemaker didn't have a lot of money, but needed space, needed a building, which the farmers built for them, just an agricultural building, and they built the creamery inside that. But that was within their budget. They were also able.
And the cheesemaker brings sweat equity to the table.
Well, in this case, it's their own business because they already had an established business.
Yeah.
So that's the second version. There's another version which is happening at the moment in my own village, where there's a dairy farm that's been established for generations. The milk is incredible. The farm manager is really a real visionary. The lays that he's been putting into the farm over the course of the last 10 years. Created this incredible pasture. He's got
what kind of cows?
He's got a mixture of British Friesian and Shorthorns, which are the native English breed. The milk's organic. The milk's amazing. And so again, they need to have a premium for this.
Otherwise,
they just
get lumped in with a whole bunch of other stuff.
Well,
that's being sold for cheap, and theirs just gets tossed in.
No one will appreciate that quality and all the work that Rob's putting into. He spent 10 years so far making this pasture, the kind of pasture that is going to produce amazing milk, particularly for cheesemaking.
Sure.
But if it's mixed in with the rest of it, it's bullshit.
It doesn't matter.
So we're getting these inquiries. People, dairy farms, they're interested in transforming, adding value to their milk. But also, what's happening more recently, we're getting people like the Trethowns, but actually people who don't make cheese at all or are interested in making cheese. So they're talking to a couple. Both work for the Canadian High Commission. They're in their early 30s. They've been making cheese at home for the last 3 years.
Okay.
Territorial cheese is what they want to make. And the cheeses they brought in from home are fantastic.
Right.
But they have no money.
They don't really have
a lot of money to start up a farm. They want to get out of London.
Yeah.
And so we've got these people approaching us who want to make cheese. Another group who are farmers that are approaching
That's
us
great.
Because they want to add value. So we just put them together.
Mm.
So I would imagine within the next 6 to 12 months, there will be one of the first raw milk, single herd, organic double Gloucesters to have been made in Gloucestershire for decades.
Right, and you did
and
that
that's
by
great.
Putting the milk
We're just,
and the cheesemakers
just
together.
Putting them together.
Yeah.
It's one of the opportunities that we have as a business is to understand the market in the middle.
Yeah.
The cheesemakers on the left and the dairy farmers on the right, have a conversation about what quality we in the middle in the market require, and inspire those other two parties
That's
to come
great.
Together and produce that level of quality which we believe will help to secure our own future. Because as I said earlier on, without that quality, of cheese, our business. Well, we just don't have a business.
You don't.
So if I'm looking into the future, I'm thinking, well, where is the future cheese going to come from?
Right.
And the future cheese has got to come from the best milk.
Yeah.
And so we need to be looking out for that. We need to understand what does the best milk mean?
Right.
How do you understand what's good milk and what's not good milk? You know, these are things that
Who's
are not
the
really,
arbitrary.
These are things that are not really spoken about.
No,
you know, you
not.
Might go, you know, you might go into any book which talks to you about making cheese, and it will say start with milk, but it doesn't say anything about what happens before that. What is milk? What is milk? What is good milk?
Right.
What is bad milk?
Who builds the fucking pasture?
Yeah,
like
yeah,
this
exactly,
guy has,
exactly.
Like layering that,
exactly.
Layering that, and it, just to go way back when you talk about direction of travel. So you see the United States, there's always been a lot of types of cheese made here,
yeah.
And there's always been mediocrity,
yeah.
Because people love cheese in the United mm-hmm. States, and these producers, as in England, there are more of them, it's a bigger country,
but
it's the same idea.
Absolutely.
You could make mold-ripened cow cheese, you mm-hmm. know, like what we would call, and we call it whatever the hell we want. Mm. We call it brie, we call it camembert, mm. we call it whatever. Mm. So that, then, and those people, they are like, hey, nobody's complaining.
Yeah,
they're
right.
buying everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, and the consumer is sort of like, well, I'm going to buy something. Like, this is all that's available to me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But now, when the milk is so cheap,
mm-hmm.
and we're starting to blur the lines, so totally here mm-hmm. with family farms versus large industrial farms, and those little people are getting eaten up, and the people who make really good milk, mm-hmm. the guy who supplied the milk to my friend Jos Volto up in upstate New York, mm-hmm. and incredible milk, but he had to sell most of it
to
Horizon, to Organic, mm-hmm. just to get that little bit for himself to make cheese,
right? Yeah, yeah.
So I see where you're talking about with the timeline
mm-hmm.
and how that breaks apart, because mm-hmm. eventually, you know, he wanted to make milk with his own. He wanted to make cheese with his own milk.
Yeah, right.
So the other guy has to go to another source to get milk.
So I think, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Not
so
completely.
So we catch up, and I think that because we move a little faster here,
yeah, exactly.
We'll catch up. It
you
might
will,
not
you
take
will.
15 years.
No, it won't.
It'll take 6 years.
Exactly, I agree.
Because we're going to run out of good milk, and
yeah,
I
yeah.
hate to be the. Or that's how.
Well, I think the, you know, so the whole discussion is around
I mean, what I'm saying making sense.
No, complete. No, it makes complete sense. And I think what's really important in this discussion and what we need to be thinking about in the future is what's
yeah.
good milk and what's it worth.
Right.
So if you know it, and it's all about moving away from the you know the
right.
an understand, you know, this perception that things should be priced, you know, in a commodity fashion. So in England 25, 30 years ago, many cheeses. Was sold, you know, in the price of many cheeses. There was sold in a commodity way. So let's take Lancashire, because we were talking about Lancashire
yes.
earlier on.
Yes.
And
like to talk about Lancashire.
So when we began as a business to buy Lancashire in the very early 80s, there was a commodity price for Lancashire cheese, and we've referred to this, I think, in an earlier episode, where
we did.
Where Mrs. Kirkham was paid £1.20. A pound for her cheese, which was more or less the same price as the big factory up the road that was charging the same thing, because the market had this there was a market price for Lancashire, irrespective of how much was made, what the quality was, whether it was farmhouse or not, whether it was raw milk or not, whether it was natural rinded or whether it was in wax. There was just kind of this understanding in the marketplace that Lancashire cost £1.20 a pound.
That's what it was.
So that's,
yeah.
that's how it went.
Sure, sure.
And so it was only when Randolph said, well, you know, when Mrs. Kirkham was about to go to the wall, that he said, look, well, if you make it for me without the wax, just with the cloth rind that's been buttered, I'll give you a premium. I'll give you an extra 50p a pound.
Sure.
Big increase.
That's huge.
Big deal for her. Saved the business.
Yeah.
So then what you're establishing is a two-tier system, mm-hmm. which is much more reflective of quality. And so I think what's happened since that moment is that we now have a much more established understanding in the marketplace of those tiers of quality.
Right.
It's all cheese.
Yeah,
it's all Lancashire.
It's like animal farm.
It's,
animals are created equal, but
yeah.
some are a little more equal than others.
Exactly. So there's Lancashire and Lancashire, but there's a different price for the two. Now, we've understood that now, I think, with cheese, but it hasn't really happened with milk. And so I think if we have a future, if we have if there's going to be a quality cheese industry in the future, then something has to happen.
There needs
to be some sort of evolution in the way that quality of milk. Understanding what quality of milk is needs to be set aside.
Yeah. I mean, there needs to be. Yeah, there needs to be two markets. There needs to be a market from milk for cheese.
Yeah, exactly.
And then within that market, milk for cheese, that gets spliced up into different types of cheese.
Yeah, yeah.
And then everything else.
Because the other thing is that you know.
Can we get there though?
Quality of milk for drinking.
Yeah.
And the constituents. That are required because you know the price that you get for your milk in England is determined to some degree by how much fat is in the milk.
Right.
But actually, milk with a lot of fat in doesn't make great cheese. What you really want is a different. You need a particular type. Different constituents that will make better cheese.
Right.
And so you know an appreciation of what those different types of milk are.
Sure.
What they're going to be transformed into,
sure.
and what your what the price for that's going to be, and you know having a more a stratification of price and quality with so, liquid milk, I think is what's going to guarantee.
So you're
the
doing this. You are doing
well,
this.
No, we're not. Well, we're.
It, well, you're I, involved.
It's just
in
beginning
it.
To happen.
Right.
Yeah.
So what do you see? So, it's I have two questions. Mm. One, as cheesemongers, who don't maybe have the reach. And the scope that the Neal's Yard Dairy does, what do we do? What do the people who listen to this program do in order to help ensure that that happens? What can we do?
What can you do? That's a big question.
Well, really, you know, because otherwise we're pissing in the wind a little bit.
I think what you have to do is you have to understand, and you have to understand from the cheeses that you're tasting, understand more, be able to trace that back more when you have a good cheese to understand why is it a good cheese.
Right.
And where in the process of the cheese, from that cheese being made to the cheese that you have in the counter, what part of that was to do with how good the milk was?
And how do you find out that information?
You have to find it.
You
need to put pressure on the people that supply you that cheese.
So you need to have a better relationship and better knowledge of where your product comes from, not only the town that it was made or the people who drive it to you, but the grass from which the milk was made. That's the type of understanding that, and this is, if we're going to sustain this and keep quality in this market, as Americans, because we're disparate here.
Yeah.
There's a lot of land here. There's a lot of milk. There's a lot of people. Mm. A lot of people do things in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
But I mean, and it makes sense. So we just got to dig deeper.
We have to understand what good milk is.
Sure.
And who's doing
that in England? You guys are working with.
We're spending much more time as a business, and not me so much, but there's others in the business looking at this much more intently. Looking at milk on farms. With the producers that we're working with, you know, there's some very simple tests that you can do to understand whether milk is good or bad.
Yeah.
And it should be, you know, really one of the things that, Bronwyn, Jen and David and others who work with us, who spend much more time on, you know, spend much of their time on farms, are encouraging cheesemakers to understand whether, you know, how good their milk is. And it's a difficult thing for them to do because the test itself is a lacto-fermentation test. So you just literally sour the milk. And once you sour that milk, it turns into a yogurt. And that yogurt could taste delicious.
And then you know...
Or if it's not very good, it will taste disgusting.
Yeah.
The least amount of ingredients, the least amount of time. But in its purest form,
right at the
beginning, you can find out whether you got good milk or not. And if you were to do that every day, and you make cheese with that milk every day...
Right.
And those two things are happening concurrently, you have a good idea whether that cheese is going to be good or bad.
Yeah.
So as a cheesemonger, we need to be tracing that back more to understand and asking more questions of the people that are transforming that milk for them to encourage them to understand, you know, how much control they have over that and how important it is for that milk to be good.
Yeah.
Because you can't make great cheese out of shit milk.
No, you can't. So to circle all the way back around to our other episode, effective cheesemongering, that's our work.
Yeah, exactly.
That's our work.
Yeah.
And that's
that is not
next
a task.
Level of work.
Indeed.
After you've gone through all the tasks we mentioned and all the work that we've done
absolutely
up to that point, That's our next level of work.
And I think that
here and in the UK and in other markets to get to where we need
I think that's the most important piece of work that all of us have to focus on in the next phase. Because if we do that, then we will safeguard the future of the farms and the cheese businesses that we all work with.
That is awesome. I'm going to end right there because that's the right spot to end. Yeah. Thank you so much, Jason, for your time. Thanks for listening. Do the work. Do the tasks. Find out where your milk comes from and whether or not it's any good. Stay tuned for more Cutting the Curd next week. Ciao.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat & 3.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you save a little room for dessert.